envision three female attorneys coming together to have our voices heard. Each of us would have different opinions, different passions, different backgrounds, and different views. Although we are different and unique, we are able to come together to discuss our experiences, navigating through the legal profession and this thing called life. Now, the vision has come alive, and we invite you each and every week to listen to us as we talk about what's trending in the news and our legal insights. Tackle real life issues that affect not only us as attorneys, but us as women of color. Howdy, and welcome to episode 6 of No Further Questions. As always, before we get started, let's run our disclaimer. Disclaimer. This podcast is intended to provide entertainment and general information. The information provided and the views given are not intended to constitute legal advice and should not be relied upon as legal representation. All views expressed on this podcast are our own and do not represent the opinions of any entity whatsoever we are affiliated with now or will be affiliated with in the future. Hey, so let's get started. Welcome to episode 6, Politics and the Law. We're doing something a little different. We're getting a little edgy. We're getting a little dicey. But let's start introducing ourselves. To my left, I have...
Hi. Hi, guys. Taria Hutchinson here.
And then to my right, I have...
Sam Frazier. Brandy, why do you have these bedroom eyes? Right.
To my left,
goodness, I have... Like, really? Y'all just call me out like that? So we have two very special guests going on, and we got an Amber Alert going off too. Maybe my phone. Anyway, we got two special guests going on today with Politics and the Law. To my immediate left, we have Mr. Demetrius Walker, who is a serial entrepreneur, author of a book called I Am a Black Man, The Evolution of a Dangerous Negro. He's an economist, founder of the Black Travel Club, and one of Houston's top DJs in the city, you know, Meek. So yeah, y'all probably heard him in these streets. He's also a graduate from Vanderbilt University with a BA in economics, and he also has an MBA and completed a graduate program in nonprofit management at Texas A&M. What up, Meek?
What up, what up? Thank you for having me.
So before we get started with you, can I call you Meek or you want me to call you Demetrius? How do you feel?
Whatever you're comfortable with. You know, I know Demetrius is a long name, you know, it's multi-syllable, so Meek is fine.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
I'm going to call you Demetrius, okay?
That's perfectly fine.
No. She's a character.
I'm undecided. It's wherever the mood feels.
Okay? Whatever, with my bedroom eyes.
That's a different story now.
And to my immediate right, we have Mr. R.W. Bray. This is the man in these streets.
Wow.
In these United States streets.
Wow.
Oh.
Yes.
What a different intro, Brandy. She's not taking sides.
Well, the reason I say that is because Mr. Bray is the president of the MLK Association of Texas and deputy director for Senator Ted Cruz, so one of our United States senators. That's why I say he had a man in these Senate streets. Mr. Bray also serves as member of the Texas Air National Guard as the first sergeant of the Logistics Readiness Squadron and is a proud member of the 100 Black Men Metropolitan of Houston. He's attended Dillard University and University of Houston downtown, and he holds degrees in both business and political science. So welcome, Mr. Bray.
Welcome. Thank you. Thank you so much.
And ladies, they both single, too.
Were you supposed to say that?
I know. What are you putting them on auction? Start the bidding.
At a dollar.
Call 1-800.
50
cents. Politics.
We're going to have to start a lot higher than that.
What's wrong with the dollar?
A dollar. Man, we're going to have to, you know, put some more zeros behind it in commas.
You know, we're going to stay focused, though.
Yeah, we're going to focus on the topic.
You're going to bring him back
later.
Hey, I'm an economist, you know. You
hey, you're going to make them coins.
Yeah, come on. He said, if you're going to human traffic, you're going to do it right today.
Facts.
Know your worth. That's right.
Know your worth, 2019.
100%.
Yes. So back on track, I can't even get it out right. Back on topic today, we're discussing three important things that are in our news at the moment. So we're going to talk about immigration, we're going to talk about economics, and we're going to talk about prison reform. So let's get started with immigration. I know when we talk about immigration a lot of times, and this is a conversation we've had with friends. I know Taria and I have had this conversation. Immigration is not necessarily Hispanics. And that's what people fail to realize. Immigration is not just, oh, we're just going to build a wall and we're going to keep the Mexicans out. It's more to that, because it's more dealing with, you got Haitians, you got Africans, you got Asians, you got so many different people, so many different minorities who are not American. So pretty much anybody who is not American, in a sense, is an immigrant, is part of the immigration crisis. So that's one thing that we have to focus on, is that, you know, when you out there trying to, you know, I guess be negative towards the situation, I always know that it could be one of your friend's cousins who is not necessarily, like I said, a Hispanic, that could be an immigrant. So I'm going to open up. Let's talk about it. That's one of the things we can talk from there. Like, let's go. Who want to start?
Sure. I'd be happy to start on immigration. I'm the son of an immigrant.
Really?
Yes. My mother immigrated here from Panama when she was 6 years old.
Oh.
And, you know, I think the thing that we need to be discussing is, okay, we do have quite a bit of people who are trying to enter this country. That's true. It's actually at a record high right now, the amount of people who are trying to enter the United States coming through our southern border. We know this. But now the question and the things that we're not discussing are why. Mm. Why are these people coming to the United States? What is causing them to leave their home, travel thousands of miles with very little money, very little food, and resources, and attempt to seek asylum in the United States? And that's what's being missed in this whole conversation. And so we have to look at the U.S.'s previous policies and how we dealt with these Central American countries that have kind of created these crises where people are now fleeing their countries due to the instability and wanting to seek asylum in the United States.
I have a question. What about the people who are immigrants who aren't seeking asylum? How about we, you know, do something about those individuals so that we can have room for people who are seeking asylum? Because there are a lot of immigrants from Europe and Canada who don't have those problems, but they choose to live in America and thus are taking up space as well, and thus cutting off some of our resources.
I don't know. I mean, I lean right, so I'm just going to come out and come over with a right.
We already know you're going to make us mad. Just say it. Just say it.
All right. We got to put it out there. This is our Republican.
I
say you lean right.
So I see immigration in two lights. You know, if it's legal immigration is good. If it's illegal, it's bad. One is constructive and one is not. When you anchor the whole conversation that these people are seeking asylum, automatically I feel as though those are the arguments that appeal to the pathos of Americans, right? So you want to appeal to pathos of Americans, then you bring up the asylum situation, you bring up the kids, right? And then all of a sudden America's heart goes out bleeding to these individuals. The truth is, though, is that, as she stated, kind of, sort of, not every one of these immigrants are seeking asylum. And it also, the fact from the situation, the simple fact that a lot of these individuals, instead of leaving that country, should be looking to better the country that they're in. And there's some national responsibility to do so, which we just saw the president kind of force Mexico into taking responsibility for their own citizens. And not only did we see Americans rejoice over this thing, but also we saw Mexicans rejoicing over the issue. The only reason why Mexicans were rejoicing is because they knew two things. Number one, even though it was a five-part issue, number one, they knew that they wouldn't have to worry about individuals on the southern border crossing over and affecting their own economics, which is what was doing on the southern border of Mexico. Now they're stopping them at the southern border of Mexico. In addition to that, for Americans, we were rejoicing because instead of having to house those individuals, in May it was over 100,000, now those individuals can now be housed in Mexico and await their trials and asylum trials from Mexico, which means that we, our taxpayer dollars, don't no longer have to go toward housing those individuals. I believe that anytime we can defer from tax burden, we should, because I honestly believe that the more money taxpayers have in their pocket, the better it is for our personal economy.
Okay, so, you know, in response to that, yes, not everyone who's in this country illegally has come in through our southern border or is attempting to come in through our southern border. The majority of illegal immigrants in this country are people who overstayed their visa, right? So I want to, you know, preface my statement with that. However, once again, we talk about all of these people coming in through the southern border of Mexico, making the trek all the way to the southern border of the United States, and we don't hold ourselves responsible for those people being in the situation that they're in due to failed policies that the United States has implemented in terms of regime change. When we look at Honduras, we look at Guatemala, we look at the economic policies that we've imposed on these countries and created political instability. Not only did we do that, but we started to deport tons and tons of gang members, many of whom never lived in those countries, that we deported simply because they didn't speak English, back to these countries who created this instability. So these countries are ruled by gang members. MS-13, you know, these countries, these people are fleeing gang violence. They're fleeing rape and murder. And so when they come to the United States to attempt to better their lives and to get themselves into a safer situation, and we close our doors and forget that we created the situation in the first place, it's extremely hypocritical of the United States to have policies where we say, you know what, you're not welcome here. Even though we messed up your country and we created all this instability and we deposed your leaders and we supported coups that created this instability, and then we dumped hundreds of thousands of gang members into your country. Yeah, we did.
D, let me get this straight.
We did.
Let me get this straight.
We did. Go look it
you,
up.
You, what you're saying is, first of all, America does not deport non-Americans.
Are you sure about that?
The Americans do not deport. And if it does, it's incidental. I'm not talking about incidentals. I'm talking about what you're claiming is that America is responsible for dumping hundreds of thousands of Americans who were committing.
Not all of them were Americans. Not all of them were.
No, that's impossible. Not all of them. So we're not talking about incidentals. And so what is the real root then? So we're not talking about incidentals. Let's not say that we're deporting Americans to these countries and we're the cause of it.
But we did.
Then we got to fall back on your incidentals. Then we got to fall back on the argument of these individuals being the cause of us having a political regime. We are not responsible for socialism. We don't encourage socialism. We're not forcing individuals into socialism. That is a decision upon every nation to decide whether or not they want to have a social dictator. Now, I'm not saying that socialism is bad. I'm not making claims. I'm saying that it may be bad for America, and it has worked out where it's not all that good for Venezuela and places like Honduras either. But if that is the case, right, some responsibility and onus has to be upon the nation itself. What your claim is that America is the cause of all of it, and that's just not true.
Well, look, obviously, people do have to take responsibility for their
national
hand.
National responsibility.
I'm not disagreeing with you there. But when the United States imposes their will on these countries and when they say, you know what, we don't want to be a democratic country, we don't want to trade with you, and we go in and we try to disrupt their political systems and we support coups and we support rebels who attempt to overthrow the governments, and they create this instability where now you have millions of people living in Honduras and Guatemala and Nicaragua who have been living in political instability for the past 50 years due to policies that the United States has implemented.
It may be a point that we totally disagree upon. You know, tomorrow I have to sit down with a group of 8 Sudanese. If I listened to your ideology, I would actually take responsibility for the fact that Sudanese militia are actually raping women who are there by themselves simply protesting for the right to have a democracy led by citizens. I cannot afford to even adopt your ideology, because I know full well that the Sudanese people that they see me tomorrow, they're taking responsibility for why their nation is in the situation they're in. I could argue that America could have done business with Sudanese long ago, who could have protected them long ago. Why are we now just speaking up? We benefited from a lot of what they did, their current government situation, because of the wars with their neighboring countries. But at the end of the day, Sudanese people, they're not looking for a handout from America. If anything, right now, they're looking for protection, a return back to civility, and some type of government-led citizenship or citizenship-led government. So if those individuals, those Stuart Neese, have the self responsibility and national responsibility to take ownership for where their country is, right? I think so does areas like Central America and Southern America.
What?
So then, here's my question. I believe I know your answer. But should the borders be open? Should everybody get a chance to come over and get the American dream?
No way.
Why?
No way. There should be not open borders. But number one, borders create stability. So for instance, if I allowed for every individual to come, whoever wanted to come, it'd be an incredible concept because there is no other nation that does that. Even if we adopted that, though, we also have to think about social welfare, economic welfare, right? I know that in my pot, in this little circle here, I know that the monies that we collect can allow for one of us, right, if we fall on our faces, to be lifted up by the other remaining standing, right? But what happens when you have an outsider, maybe the person with her headphones, who comes in here, and now she sits at the table too, and she offers her uncle and her nephews and everybody else in her family to come, but the initial concept, the structural concept, right, that we knew that we could sustain ourselves if one fell, is all gone now. It's gone. So now the only thing's left, and this is I'm going to say this last. I don't believe that altruism is virtuous. I don't at all. Because at some point, you run out of money. If you have no more to sacrifice, now you're dependent. And then the concept of altruism is you keep giving until you don't have any more. Then now she gives, and now she's dependent. And now it was just us two trying to hold three people down. That's never the structural concept.
But with that mindset, your assumption is that the person that's coming in is bringing nothing to your group. You're basically saying the person with the headphones comes in, and all she's doing is sucking the life. When really, that person with the headphone could be the thing that take your group to the next level. But you don't know, because all you want are the people that was in the group to get high off the hog. You don't want to share with the other person who may bring some new dynamics.
Which is the point of responsible immigration, which is why we have E1, EB1, EB2, EB3.
Yeah, but the problem with responsible immigration is, let's be honest, when you want to get a visa, right, they ask you what your occupation is. They ask you what you do for a living, how much you want to bring in. And, you know, I've worked for an immigration firm before. I used to do immigration law. The country will let in those of a certain socioeconomic stance into the country who have a certain educational background, yep, and who offer a certain, rise to a certain, at least middle class in their country, at least.
Or the potential
for middle class, right? So, but that's to say that if someone doesn't have that opportunity that's in their country, that it's a lot harder for them to come in the legal way, even though they may come in and offer more than the engineer and his family who can come over here and get a visa easier, because it's not easy, but quicker than the average quote-unquote undocumented immigrant.
I mean, since America has been founded, immigrants have been a net benefit to the United States. I mean, I think that's indisputable, right? Immigrants are actually extremely exploited. You know, the immigrants who do, you know, manage to come over here and work for wages that no Americans would ever work for. So, you know, they're extremely exploited. But going back to your point on Sudan, right? So if we want to discuss Africa, once again, we can't be so short-sighted in our memory to look at the policies of colonialism and how colonialism from European and Western nations have created the dysfunction that we see in Africa today. You know, so that's to your point on Sudan. The United States, when we economically decide that we're going to freeze out a country, look, they have socialist leadership. We're not going to trade with them. We're not going to allow any of our allies to trade with them. And that just, you know, it amps up the instability in these regions. And then, you know, when common citizens get caught in a crossfire, you know, due to policies that we've implemented, and they, you know, they say, look, we need some help. And we shut them away and we shut down and say, there's no way we want you coming to our country, even though we pretty much are the foundation and the root of the problem. I think that's unfair. And I think that, you know, both parties, Democrat and Republican, really have to assess our hand and our role, America's role, in creating a lot of the dysfunction and instability that we see not only in Latin America, but as well as Africa.
I just think that the economic, how do I say this? I believe in black economics. I believe in the sustainability of black economics and our ability to grow. When you think about something, the comment that you made, you said, well, you know, some Americans are just not going to accept that job. I just call BS on that. I think that there are a lot of times when you have black labor that are truly looking to create their new companies. And a lot of those companies that blacks are trying to create, especially black males, maybe those who don't have a college education or may not be looking to become a doctor, maybe they still have an entrepreneurial spirit and they want to do something in the area of construction or maybe something in the area of landscaping and things of the like, right? Well, you hear huge arguments in California right now where neighborhoods, black neighborhoods are like, please stop the immigration, stop. Why? It's because you have a lot of black and brown economic back and forth, where once black wealth was bent off of certain services, now where you have someone who's illegal coming through and they're undercutting the labor. So they're able to do more with less and offer their service for less. Now the individual who wants the yard cut or construction done, whatever the case may be, the labor market is being cheapened, and African Americans who once maybe did great in those fields aren't necessarily doing great in those fields anymore. So you say immigration is good. I do believe that. I believe immigration is good. I believe that at some point, immigration, the overload of immigration is bad, because if the area cannot sustain all those individuals and it causes black Americans not to prosper, I got a problem.
That's okay. Called capitalism.
That's called
point blank, period.
And that's called
unless of course you're American. Now you're American, you be another American, I consider that fair.
Well, here's my answer to that. You know, of course, you know, I'm not advocating that we overrun our cities and just allow everybody, whoever wants to come to the United States, to just be here and, you know, consume our resources. That's not what I'm advocating. But what I'm saying is, and this is where I feel that the Republican Party as well as the Democratic Party fall short, is saying that if someone can come over here without being able to speak the language, without having the skills or the education, and come here day one and compete for jobs with black Americans who have been in this country for centuries, that's a problem in and of itself that needs to be fixed. We shouldn't, there's no way an immigrant should be able to come over here day one, not speak the language, and be able to compete for a job with someone who's been here for three centuries.
But why not? Because at the end of the day, when you say things like that, like that person skill set, this person is still an adult human being. They just come from a different country. The skill set is a skill set.
Well, now when I say I'm referring to unskilled labor versus skilled labor, right? So we live in a country where black Americans, like I said, we've been here for centuries. There's no reason why we should be competing for the same jobs that people come over here without any education, or any formal education, or being able to speak the language. We should not be the same people competing with these people for jobs.
Why?
Whose problem is that, though?
Yeah, like,
well, this is the United States' problem. This is where the United States has done a huge disservice to black Americans in the first place, for the fact that if black Americans are the ones being mostly affected by illegal immigrants coming over here, what does that say? That means we haven't educated black Americans to the same level that we've educated white Americans, because, yeah, you brought up the fact that they're competing with black Americans, right? So if this is who they're taking away jobs from, why is it that they're competing with black Americans in the first place? What disservice has been done to the point where black Americans are not at the same level as white and Asian Americans and not having to worry about illegal immigrants coming over to take our jobs?
So shift your eyes around this table.
Yeah.
Shift it around. There's five of us sitting at this table.
Mm-hmm.
Shift it.
Right.
I'm not competing.
I'm not either.
So
I'm responding to the point that he made, that he claims that there are people in California, black Americans in California. You claim that there's black Americans in California who are complaining about the illegal immigrants coming over here and begging for it to stop.
Well, because as an illegal immigrant, you know how this game works. If an illegal immigrant comes to my house and says, hey, I'm gonna cut your yard, I'm paying him underneath the table, versus the citizens, there's a whole other game that goes into play.
Exactly. What are you struggling for? What are you saying no for? This is reality. It happens. That's underskirting labor.
So who are they taking these jobs from? When they come in to knock on your door to cut your lawn, who else is coming to your door to knocking on your door and say, hey, let me cut your lawn?
Well, the other visual that would have already knows. Can I just give me an example?
Yeah, no,
Let me give you an example, right? In constructions, right? Yeah. Well, they're not hypotheticals. It's reality. If you understand what the game, like she just mentioned, like I've seen this game because it comes through my office, right? So if let's just say someone works in construction, right? But mm-hmm. he or she, like you said, gets paid from the forum. He's gonna get cash, right? But the cool thing is that Maria, right? She opens up a truck, right? It's cool because Maria owns a truck. Maria's an entrepreneur, right? So she opens up a truck. She's selling tacos out the truck. You know how she's making it though. She can actually apply for government aid, right? Suddenly, every grocery that she needs is already paid for. Not by Maria, but it's subsidized by Americans. So now that's free. That's free, right? That's free groceries she uses to sell. No money out of her pocket. Free money she's using. Not to mention her husband is out working construction, getting paid under the table. Right. Now she's making more money. She's making money on top of the money that the backs of the labor of Americans have gotten. That happens every day.
Okay, so that was fun talking about immigration.
Yeah. I was about to say, because we're going to have to stop talking about Maria, and we're going to have to start talking about Ellen from France, okay? Because I'm tired of y'all sitting up here talking about all the Central Americans and the southern borders other
European
groups coming over here.
Yeah, I heard that. But I mean, we were trying to talk about because we're talking about economics and you threw economics in there, especially black economics. I know one thing that is particular when it comes to economics is like dealing with student loans and what it means for our nation's, you know, future economy. Because in my opinion, they can get rid of my student loans, throw them away. Yep, I don't want to pay them back.
I will go on record: whoever has the best student loan plan gets my vote.
Yes.
2020.
Yes, out of all the people running,
I don't care what your other policies are.
Because I
talk student loans
and tell me that they're going away.
Mm-hmm. But I don't want to hear about what you're doing for these new class. Okay, what can you do for me?
So, what does it look like? Because that's my dream and hope. The miracle, my prayer right now, I'm fasting on it, and I'm seeking the Lord. And if God blesses me to get mm-hmm. these wiped out,
I've seen what you've done for others, Morehouse.
What does it look like if these student loans get wiped out? Because I feel like it should be a threshold. I'm about to make some people mad. But if you have six figures, let's go ahead and cast out those, right? Mm-hmm. If you have 15,000, sit down.
Don't come to me with that 15,000.
A significant amount, right? It's the professionals that are really struggling with this game because of the amount of student loans that mm-hmm. we have. So what would that look like if we did check our name for the person that had the best student loan?
I want to say this real quick. If there's a billionaire out there, you can pay for my student loans. Go ahead.
That's right. So current statistics are showing that within 12 years, white males are actually paying off 44% of their student loans, which is an incredible amount of money. You think you consider that in 12 years.
I'm sorry, you said white males?
White males.
But aren't they like the highest paid? Because, you know, nobody else is getting paid.
Exactly. And here's the issue.
Asian males are the highest paid.
And here's it. Well, that's true.
It ain't black people.
So and what's so crazy, though, in that same stat, black females, their particular loans are actually increasing by 11%. Now, what that means is that the same issues, one of the main issues that whites have, and I guess is a privilege, if you will, is that they have transferable income or transferable wealth. It's something that a lot of us in our families, we didn't have an opportunity to do. So when Big Mama dies, 9 times out of 10, a lot of black families, they're actually incurring debt, especially land debt, right? Mm-hmm. Where they can't, mama took advantage of the tax exemption, right? And she thought, oh yeah, I'm gonna pass my house. And then all of a sudden, the house got $20,000 worth of debt and the family can't pay for it, right?
She got a reverse mortgage.
One knew about, right? And you're like, dang, what happened to the black wealth? Well, the black wealth was given because somebody miseducated my big mama, right? Between default and an exemption, right? So, now, I'll cross this up, but the simple point to this is that without transferable wealth, then all of a sudden you see these preferentials where you see this huge wealth gap, not necessarily because we didn't get an education, because we did, but we took on more debt than the other guy had to, right? And he's able to pay back his debt because his mom or dad dies and has transferable wealth. We don't have that benefit. So there are some interesting economies where you can say, okay, well, in this particular situation, there should be some type of forgivable debt for that individual, right? Mm-hmm. But we're talking about thousands, millions of Americans now.
Yeah, and you know, this crisis is, you know, the numbers are astronomical when we look at how many people are sinking in student loan debt. The other part of the equation that we're not discussing, though, is the fact that wages have not risen in this country in 15 years.
Chick-fil-A has. They paying $17 an hour. I need to go work there part-time. I'm just saying. Chick-fil-A.
And Bucky's is $17.50.
With benefits.
If you break it down by the hour, yes, you probably make more money at Bucky's
than I do at my current job. Yes. Being a lawyer, I think I might make more and have less stress.
Hey, you got to weigh the opportunity. Right? Yeah, you got choices, you know, Bucky's or be a lawyer.
But less stress at Bucky's.
Yeah, we have to talk about in this country, what do we need to be doing differently on a macroeconomic scale to improve the situation in terms of wages, right? Because wages have been flat for 15 years now. And so that's the presidential candidate that I'm gonna go with, is whoever can solve this economic equation where we get out of these flat wages and, you know, our wages have to increase. You know, we look at the cost of goods. We could even look at here in Houston, right? The cost of living in the city of Houston has increased astronomically since I've been here. I came in 2007, I had a one bedroom apartment, $525 a month by the Galleria. That's not happening right now. You're talking about $1,500 a month, right? And that's in the course of 12 years. Right.
It's higher than that.
Yeah, you're talking about $1,500 to $2,000, right?
And for a 500 square bedroom apartment, yes.
And now you add your student loan on top of that, and you're getting paid the same wage that people were getting paid in 2007. In 2019, there's no way people could pay their student loans back. So I need to vote for the candidate who's going to show me economically how we're going to fix this.
Right, but they're not going to fix it because it's big business.
Right? It is, that runs it and controls it.
Because that's a lot of money that's going to waste.
Because I'm
pretty
sure.
Unless there's some sort of hacker out there who's...
And I'm not advocating
for
that.
I'm not advocating for hacking.
However.
Now, however, I'm just saying.
Y'all hacking the wrong people. I'm just saying.
Stop peddling with stuff that don't matter, like CIA stuff. Switch.
Stop worrying about credit cards and targeting stuff.
Stealing people's identity.
Yeah.
That's chump change.
We need our identity. We struggling with these student loans.
I do.
Go ahead. I had a question, which.
Go ahead.
So, okay, I do believe there needs to be some macro answers, right? And I do believe that, I'm along with you, there should be a candidate that may offer that macro answer that he's referring to. But here's where I go back to personal responsibility. Or at the very least, cultural responsibility, right? Why don't we deal with something a lot more micro? For instance, why don't we deal with the fact that we can start redefining what education is within our culture, if not America alone? But let's just deal with our culture, black Americans alone. What if we start redefining education? We say, listen, here, not everyone is cut out for four-year colleges. Especially looking at the stats, we see how many people are actually dropping out, right? Maybe education or the redefine of education might be that you actually are very good at being a pipe fitter. Baytown is hiring $35 an hour, right, for pipe fitters. You can actually become a lineman and make $80,000 going to Texas Tech, and staying in there for less than a year and come out making $80,000, right? Now, here's the crazy thing. If you still want to go to college, you can. But you can actually offer $80,000 a year as a pipe fitter or a lineman, put yourself through college or school, finish in 5 years with no debt. When we start redefining what education is, we had this huge push in the late 70s, early 80s. Everyone needs to get education. By the time we fast forward into the 90s, no one was talking about vocational training anymore. Everyone was going to four-year colleges, and then all of a sudden, the federal government was giving money to any high school that had a lot of people going to college. Now all these high schools abandoned vocational training. It was like, we want more points, we want more money. We're going to push everybody to school. All of a sudden, what increased? National debt.
Hold that thought.
Oh, school debt, that is.
Hold that thought. Taria, your question?
So my question, what happened to the middle class?
Dun, dun, dun. Stay tuned for episode 7. We'll answer that question. So please follow us at No Further Questions on Facebook, No Further Q on Instagram, and at NFQ Pod on Twitter. And catch us on the next episode so we can wrap it up and figure out what happened to the middle class. Bye.